this episode of the Be Better podcast. A big thank you, as always, to all our regular listeners. Please like, share, subscribe, all that jazz on all the different platforms. It does help. And maybe you can help spread the word to someone who really needs to hear about B Corp and awesome purpose performing humans. Anyway, with all that aside, with me today, I have the man, the myth, the legend himself, Graham Ross from BlockTex. G'day, Graham.
Hey, Tim. Great to be here.
It's been a while. I'm trying to think, when was the last time? I think the last time we connected was about 2 or 3 years ago, maybe, when you came and did a cheeky session for the MBA crew that I was co-teaching at the time, talking to them about all the amazing stuff that you do. So it's been a fair while. But yeah, for people who don't know who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, thanks. Any time to get to spend time with you, my friend.
Oh, cheers,
buddy. Don't do it nearly enough. So
I know.
We've got to do it. But this is a great start, and then hopefully one of us will jump across the ditch and spend some quality time together.
Big good idea.
So my name is Graham Ross. I'm the co-founder of BlockTex. We are a textile resource recovery company. We developed a technology to deal with unwanted clothing and textiles, as we all know. As fast fashion came along and took over our wardrobes, and the quality of the materials of the clothes we love and wear, they just don't last as long as they used to. And there's a large volume of them. And like most things like batteries or tires, there's an opportunity to recycle those things, and textiles didn't have that sort of opportunity. Often it would be gathered up and exported overseas to another country. And just the sheer volume of material going around the world meant that we needed to come up with a better solution. So we developed a chemical separation process, and it all sounds a bit, you know, wild and crazy and excited, but really, it's essentially taking your unwanted textiles and deconstructing them back to their raw materials. And so we effectively look at polyester cotton blended materials across everywhere. So things you walk on, things you sit on, things you wear. That gives us about nearly 90% of the world's fabrics. And we put it through a process, which I'm happy to delve into, but as an overview, put it through a process that we then unlock the cotton from the polyester, and we turn those two materials back into raw materials that can be reused into many industries, including the fashion industry.
So many questions about this. What drugs were you smoking the day you came up with this idea? Like how, what, and why? Really, are sort of the three questions that come up. So
yeah,
I would guess like why fast fashion? Trying to solve that problem. We'll start there.
Yeah, absolutely. So my background, I was in media, but I moved into textiles about nearly 10 years ago, and I formed a sustainable sportswear range. That business was great. It was successful. It was awarded B Corp over many years, but also realized I was never going to be Nike. And what I did understand by being part of the industry, that there was a huge amount of that value that we were sending to landfill, because I'd physically paid to make fibers, I'd physically paid to make fabrics, and I'd physically paid to make garments. And so at the end of life, it was just getting sent to landfill, just like it was a waste piece of paper or a waste plastic tub. And that didn't make any sense. And I was introduced to my business partner, Adrian Jones, and he's got a background in the textile industry from the start. So he was in Marks and Spencer's in the UK, opened up a bunch of stores across Europe, and then eventually came to Australia and ran retail brands here in Australia. And so he's going through a sense of atonement, because he was the guy flogging all those frocks to everybody and ending up in landfill. So we had this great opportunity to get together with sort of my curiosity and my sort of lifelong entrepreneurship and his background in the fashion industry, combining those two strengths. And we've been able to we looked at the industry and said, well, if we could come up with a concept that actually diverted textiles away from landfill, but we brought them back to raw materials so they could be reused again and again and again, that would be the holy grail of the fashion industry. And so he often tells the story that we started to write the business plan on a napkin in a cafe over a couple of glasses of wine, and sort of depending on which story, the glass of wine get longer or shorter, but we moved offices, and we actually found that napkin. So it's that real original entrepreneur story. Here's the business plan, and we've actually executed that. It is pretty much true. There's been a lot of left and rights and ups and downs, but it exists. And so we fundamentally knew that if we could do that, then that would open up not only a great business and a manufacturing business, but actually would be the start of an industry. And so that's, we firmly believe BlockTex is the start of the future textile resource recovery industry, which doesn't exist in Australia or New Zealand or effectively anywhere in the world. And I think it's a huge opportunity. This is the inflection point. And I often talk to people, they say, why, you know, everybody kind of goes, we kind of, they think we're a Tesla, but I actually have to keep telling them that we're more like a Model T Ford. Right. But we really are at that crust, that really important point where there's an industry to grow and that delivers economic value, it delivers social impact, but also delivers a really strong environmental impact into the region where it's operating.
Awesome. So, I mean, a proper circular economy, but at a sector scale rather than at a either an organizational scale or potentially just a product scale. And that's where I think, yeah, like you say, that's where you're a Model T Ford, because you're building a whole new sandpit, a whole new industry sector, rather than, yeah, making something go a bit faster or look a bit sexier and more exciting than what was previously, or be more impactful rather.
So when you've got a million tons of textiles going to landfill here in Australia, a million tons. Now, there's some great opportunities to turn things into reuse and turn them into blankets or repair them and send them out to market. But the bottom line is there's still year on year a million tons going into landfill. And so globally, we're talking about 140 million tons around the world that going into landfill. What we need is commercial scale solutions to deal with a problem we've created. But it's also an opportunity to get those raw materials back into the supply chains, which means you're not actually going back into the land and pulling out fossil fuels to then make the products that you could actually be recycling in the first place. And so I think it's both a combination of advanced chemistry, advanced manufacturing, and advanced business models, but it's actually old-fashioned thinking in regards to reuse, redesign, redistribute, those kind of things. So it's kind of new meets old, and I don't think that's too hard for people to understand. It's just that you just need a couple of older gentlemen with a passion for it to drive it forward.
Yeah, you see, I got called a boomer the other day. I'm 45. I resent that accusation. So I'm like, I'm getting older, but
I just was on a call with my marketing department. I still don't get Instagram, but I was politely told that I don't need to, so I left it at that.
Reasonable. Don't get me started on TikTok. But anyway, that's so cool that you've still got the napkin. It's interesting on the B Corp connection, sort of similarities with the beginnings and the sort of the genesis of B Corp, where the founding or one of the co-founders, Jay Cohen Gilbert, coming from the sort of fashion sports apparel industry. Hey, you know, the business could maybe do how we were doing it a bit better. Just sort of interesting the parallels. So in that initial meeting, because I mean, like I say, you've invented this thing. Was it some sort of Heath Robinson design with, like, you know, we put things in a machine and magic happens? What was the sort of the ideation process and that you were sort of hashing out in that initial meeting?
Yeah, it's we talk about a lot in business, and I think in all my businesses over my years, it's always been about what I call the road work. Like, having a great idea is really important, and then you need to validate that idea. And so you need to take your fabulous little idea, and you've got to go out and talk to as many people as possible. And you've got to find the people who believe in what you are trying to achieve. You've got to find the people who don't believe, because often you learn a lot from the people who don't believe in your vision, because they're kind of giving you a new perspective. Mm-hmm. And so you can take that advice, and you can then refine your business. Or ultimately, you can also disagree, because there's going to be people who like your idea and don't like you. That's fine. But that's part of the conversation. So what we did initially was we started really looked at business as usual. So if I donate my clothes to charitable shops, where do they go from there? And so we went and spoke to a lot of charitable shops so we understand what the flow of garments were from an initial business as usual. And often it was about, there was a great revenue stream of putting the material into a container and sending it to another country where it would then get on sold. But often what would happen, these companies, you would lose sight of where it would go. So you may sell it to a third party, expecting it to go to country A, and it goes to country B. or it goes into landfill in country C. And that's obviously not the reason of sending it off sea. So that was really interesting from our point of view. So then that gave us an idea to go, well, what if we could deal with the unwanted clothing here on shore, and what would that look like? And so we looked at doing what they call a mechanical recycling process, where you take a whole bunch of garments and you shred it all up, and then you turn it into large balls of fluff. And from that fluff, you can then spin a yarn, which then you can weave into a fabric. And so we did that work with our national scientific department, CSIRO. And so we turned that into a yarn, and that was all very successful. But there's no spinning capabilities here in this country. So it would mean that we could create all these large containers full of fluff that we'd then have to send overseas, which is kind of like the business as usual we were trying to change. We then moved into an area that was called chemical separation. And that's where you use chemicals and some other conditions to be able to separate blended fabrics. Now, blended fabrics wasn't a problem up until we kind of moved into fast fashion about 20 years ago. Because most of our garments were either made from a natural fiber like cotton, or it was made from like 100% polyester from the sort of 60s, 70s. Polyester can be both a goodie and a baddie, depending on which way you look at it, because it's made from fossil fuels. It is a plastic, but it does have good wear, good strength, and last. It's pretty much indestructible. And so as fast fashion started to evolve, what they needed was for garments that were low price, and they could get some longevity out of them. And so they started to blend the polyester and the cotton. So I'm sure all the listeners would have bed sheets or stayed in hotels that have got bed sheets that feel really quite nice. Well, they've got a higher content of cotton. And if you stay in a hotel that's probably a little bit sort of slippery in the sheets, that's probably got a higher content of polyester. But that means the longevity of those sheets is increased by the usage of polyester. Mm-hmm. And so the problem was you couldn't recycle it. There was no technology to separate those two materials. What they could do is go through that mechanical process that I described before and turn that into yarn. But every time you did it, you got a poorer quality material. So it wasn't really the solution. And the volumes got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so we looked at a bunch of opportunities, both in the laboratory and what was being done around the world too. And they were doing, one was either wasting the polyester to get the cotton, or they're wasting the cotton to get to the polyester. And that didn't make any sense to us, because you were basically trying to divert things away from landfill, and then you were still creating a problem by doing your process. So we went down this route of trying to work out, how do we develop a technique that retains both the children, so to speak. We initially started with a polyester and wool technology, and that gave us access into how we may be able to do it from which chemicals or which conditions. And then we took that into polyester cotton, because polyester cotton, as I said before, that gives us nearly 90% of the world's fibers. Polyester is about 60% of the world's fibers, and cotton is only about 3%. So from a commercial point of view, we want as big a food group as possible. Once we could successfully do that in the laboratory, we then took that to a small pilot facility. Now, at that stage, we were working very closely with the university, who had a biorefining plant up in North Queensland, and they were dealing with sugarcane offcuts and bagasse and those kind of things. And so we had to retool that particular facility to become a textile recycling facility, which actually started with the first piece of equipment we ever built for this state-of-the-art business was a commercial washing machine and a commercial dryer, because that's what we needed. But it was really, at that stage, it was really hands-on. It was, we were literally had buckets. We had buckets and moved things between buckets, and they were just learning the techniques. And so we worked with a lot of companies here in Australia. We worked with Patagonia and Apple internationally. They sent material to us. And at that stage, we could do 5 kilogram batches, which was remarkable. The experience to have written down a business plan on a napkin, to find yourself in a large scale kind of pilot facility with your hard hat on, or your rubber gloves and that kind of stuff, and actually watching your chemistry do what you asked it to do is phenomenal. It is one of the greatest experiences, it's one of the most terrifying, but one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my working career. And so from there, knowing that we could do that technical separation, then we could start to look at moving into commercial. And so going the per commercial in, sorry, going the pilot facility, we raised a small amount of seed money to just allow us to kind of carry on. We had a great experience where we were named one of the world's top 50 startup companies in the climate sector. We flew over to Paris at the end of 2019 to pick up our award, and we were quite chuffed. And we were met with a lot of companies across Europe, and we were pretty confident that we'd raised enough money to build our commercial scale plant. And we came back to Australia, and we had those conversations continued in January and then into early February. And by the time we got to February, a thing called COVID hit the world,
Nice.
and everybody went away. And so we basically spent 2020 in laboratories and just trying to, keep motivated and keep moving while everybody dealt with that sort of stuff. And then finalized our raise into sort of 2021, and then we built our factory. But I think the most important thing as we started to look at this, we had to obviously invent a lot of the equipment, but also we spent time in existing industries. So we spent time in the laundry industry because they deal with a lot of wet material and moving large clothing around. And we spent time in the craft brewery industry. Part of that was because we like a nice craft beer,
To say,
but
how much of that was actually relevant to the business planning?
I've got some very good friends that I'm keeping friends for a very long time. No, but importantly, when you want it, we looked at this from a point of view that we wanted to make a scalable and modular business. And so craft breweries are great from that point of view. So it'd be like you and I would be going, hey, you want to brew some beer? We go, yeah, sure, your garage or my garage. We'd make a great batch. You get your mates over, they go, this is great. All of a sudden you find yourself in a large factory and you've got these big vats. You go, how did we get here? Craft breweries know how to scale. And scaling our business is about adding extra vats. So it's a really simple process. We took a lot of knowledge for those two industries, how to scale and also how to deal with the movement of large materials around. And so just to wrap up this answer, the pilot facility was 5 kilogram batches. We now do 1,000 kilogram batches. So that's the difference in scale. And we've had to wrap a whole lot of advanced manufacturing around that. When you 1,000 kilograms is the weight of a small car.
Nice.
Yeah.
I just have images of you pouring the first mix into the first 5 kilo bucket, and like, a chemistry experiment gone wrong.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like
We'd love.
black, black, blackened faces and hair standing
Yeah.
on end. Yeah, I think back to the drawing board, Adrian.
No, we had lots of those. I mean, part of developing new business models and new techniques and whatever is the failure because you learn. And one of the key catchphrases we have in our business is that we're pioneering because it allows us to push forward into the unknown. It allows us to make mistakes without feeling like we've failed. And it also gives that kind of that level, keeps that level of excitement as you are failing, that you're not actually failing, you're actually moving forward. And it certainly resonates for us as founders, but also as a team.
We've been talking to quite a few sort of startup-y B Corps just recently, and that failure piece is, a common theme. But it's that whole fail forward, fail fast. If you're not pushing the boundaries, if you're not being curious, then you're never going to fail. And if you're not being curious and pushing the boundaries, you're probably not going to get to where you need to get to in a startup environment. So yeah, I think it's
Absolutely.
good to
Well,
keep hearing that.
that's very true. One of the things we find when you're dealing with science, because science is very much part of our business, is that, and thankfully, scientists are very naturally cautious people, and so are engineers, because they deal with some very serious things. But when you're an entrepreneur and trying to move a new business forward, getting to perfection isn't always the goal. Getting to good enough or near enough gets you enough data to then move to the next stage. And I think a lot of, certainly in our space, we've seen companies not get to where they needed to because they were probably focused more on making the science perfect, when in actual fact, you just got to keep evolving, evolving, because you're moving many, many things forward. And you can't just say, like, you could have the best science, best chemistry, but no business model because the business has moved on. You've missed the boat, right? So you've got to be thinking about it from a business point of view. It's always about, what does this look like from an economic success, married to tying off that it works from a science and engineering point of view?
Yeah, I definitely got I won't name them. There's a couple one sort of entrepreneurial person that I know, yeah, would spend way too long over-engineering it, and it would work perfectly for them. But you put it into the hands of anyone else and it was too good. They couldn't understand the depth of the science behind it. And there's another company I know who've got, similar to you, they've got like a groundbreaking technological idea that would revolutionize an industry, but they're seeking perfection. And it's like, guys, you're just not going to get there. And I think, was it Reid Hoffman, who was the founder of LinkedIn? He always said you should be so embarrassed of the first iteration when you look back on it. Like that's the key to knowing that you launched at the right time. So 100% agree. So neither you nor Adrian have a chemistry background. So presumably you sort of, so at what point were you kind of like, actually, we might need to go and talk to someone who knows some shit here rather than us just putting more mad schemes on a napkin? And what glass of wine level was that? Or was that bottle number three?
This is, we pushed the wine to the side. No, we're very methodical. We're both business people. And so we came at it from a point of view of, what does this look like? What would it look like for it to be economically successful? So how do you get to break even? What do the numbers look like? That's kind of separate to the science, because the science piece and the business model for us was about passion and the want to do something from an environmental point of view. So that was kind of a given, but the rational business part of us, and also the fact that, you know, we'd invested all our money in this business, we need to kind of go, well, if we build this, you can't go, I'm going to build this and they will come. That's a great way of going broke, especially in the recycling sake, because you can find plenty of waste. What you need to do is have customers who want to buy your recycled product, and you've got to have a process that is going to be cost effective to help you achieve that goal. And so, but the science was always part of that, was always ticking along next to us. And so, because this had never been done before, you couldn't just go to somebody and ask the question. You had to go across both here in Australia and internationally, the right scientists or the right industry, just to ask the right questions and just kind of find those. Often think about when you're building early stage business, you got to kind of go, you're trying to get to the top, but you can't get to the top at the first go. What you need to do is find a ledge to get to. And so it was just about getting to the next ledge, taking a pause, having an understanding of what you've achieved and where you want to go, and then strategically trying to find where that next ledge is. And so then you get to that. And so we spent a lot of time across industry and academia, in laboratories and in our workforce and on calls, just trying to understand what were the chemical successes out there? Had they got to a commercial scale? How did that marry into our feedstock, which was fashion and textiles? And to work out at what stage did we need to bring those experts into our business? Because nobody had the answer. What Adrian and I bring to us is an incredible passion for what we're doing, and enthusiasm for driving forward to actually realize this industry. But we're both really curious. And so... you don't need to have all the answers. You just need to know what were the questions you need to ask to kind of drive you in the right directions. And my background's in media, so I'm used to, you know, having a little bit of knowledge about a lot of things. And so understanding, taking in, you know, really complex things, and then trying to articulate that back into where we need to go to. And Adrian's skill set, he's very analytical. He's got a great mass brain. He's got a little bit of chemistry on the side. And so joining those together allowed us to kind of formulate a strategy to navigate our way to the right people to talk about things. And then once you turn up to people and you say, hey, this is what I want to do, and you turn up with enthusiasm and respect for what they do in their profession, people are really helpful. They really want to share their knowledge. They don't want to do what you do because, you know, I'm not sure whether I want to do what I do, because they're kind of going, this is a great idea, but you're crazy, right? There's so many barriers to entry. So people really willing to help, and then you need to find a group of a collection as you kind of move around, so you could bounce those ideas across things. And then as we started to get more and more into a factory, you had to bring in engineering, and that adds a whole layer of complexity, because you're physically moving a small car around the plant every 90 minutes. And so if there's safety, there's engineering needs, you've got to find equipment that can do that, and you've got to be able to pull that together in a short amount of time and a very small budget.
Nice. I think is it Einstein who's got that quote, you know, if I had 5 minutes to solve a problem, I'd spend 4 minutes, 50, trying to think of the right question to ask. I think media, you know, I've got a sales background. I think, yeah, media, sales, possibly also sort of like detective police work, that innate curiosity, like I don't need to know the subject, I just need to work out what questions I need to ask to unlock the subject. I think that's it's such a powerful skill to have. I mean, it can be annoying, ask my wife. And then,
ask
you know,
mine.
Yeah, but why? But why? But how? Yeah. But yeah, I think, yeah, that sort of inner child of curiosity is it's
absolutely,
particularly in a startup. Yeah, if you're wanting to get into a business, or yeah, just do more in your business, just that constant, I kind of call it the constructive discontent as well. It's like, yeah,
yeah, nice.
That could be better, and it annoys me that it's not better, and I want to know why it's not better, and I want to know what people have tried to try and make it better. And yeah, that whole, yeah, it's a whole, I don't know, there's probably a degree you can do in that these days. But yeah,
I
people either have it or they don't have it, to a degree.
I agree. I've been doing a lot of traveling lately, and I love traveling, not from the point of going away from home, but there's all these opportunities just to then review things or think about things or catch up on a bit of reading or just go back through our, you know, our data room and go, oh, that's right, where did we get to with this? And so it just opens up so many more things, and having that curiosity means it's not a task, it's actually a pleasure. You enjoy thinking about things and analyzing where you are, and we've needed this in this business. This has been an incredibly difficult 5.5 years, because nothing has come easy. We've had to either knock it over, build it, repair it, go around it. And that's just the nature of the beast. And if we weren't curious, I think one of us would have, would have bailed on us.
So, well, curious and clearly that sense of mission and purpose, because if you didn't really, really care about solving this problem, I mean, we were sort of just talking before we went live, and you were kind of like, yeah, it's hard yakka. And I feel the same with the whole trying to educate people on the B Corp journey. Like I said before, you know, people are kind of, they're keen to chat about it now, but 8 years ago, it was just a desert of purpose and meaning and do good in your business. But if doing good was easy, everyone would be doing it. And so, you know, kudos to you for taking on a super grunty problem and giving it a really good nudge. I just also imagine, you know, when you sort of knocked on the doors of these scientists, them sort of going, sorry, you want to do what?
Oh, yeah, we've had plenty of that. And who are you?
Yeah. Say that again. Yeah.
Why do you want to do that? And also, I think there's parts of our industry that are really keen on this, and there's a lot of parts of the industry that just don't care. It's like, well, my job is to sell clothes, not to recycle them, right? And so why can't you guys go off and do that? But what you do need in this industry, you need entrepreneurs like ourselves. You need government policy to help stimulate the market to support that. You need the industry itself to start to retool itself to look to the future, because they can't keep doing business as usual. And if those all combine, then you can find a lovely layer of private investors who are looking for good businesses to invest in. And increasing, like you're saying, good businesses that have another purpose over and above the economic return, social impact, environment impact, and economic return. And for me, they're the real key structures to what a business should look like going forward.
Yeah, and increasingly, that is what we're seeing. You know, I think you guys in Aussie are about to have some regulation, or if not, it's there or thereabouts, around mandatory disclosures on environmental impact for companies over a certain size. We're already seeing here at the big end of town in New Zealand, the same's happening in Europe.
Yeah,
you know, at the big end of town. But of course, if you are a supplier into one of these big end of town companies, well, they're going to want to know some stuff about you. So it's going to be coming. One way or the other. All of the above. Yeah, supply chain pressure, customer pressure, employee pressure. I think it will be, you know, what we're seeing from people who are interested in B Corp, FMCG, fast moving consumer goods. Mm-hmm. So definitely food and beverage, health and beauty, and fashion to a degree, are sort of like leading the charge, really, because of that brand, I guess, association, as well as obviously wanting to do the right thing. And we're definitely noticing that in a lot of those industries, B Corp is now almost table stakes. And so the next thing the consumer is looking for is the what next? And I think that's where you're going to very soon have a lot of these fashion companies going, oh, actually, the differentiator now isn't just we're a B Corp, it's we're a B Corp plus BlockX. It's a B Corp plus block tax plus any virgin material we get is, you know, sourced socially and environmentally, and it's traceable and it's got provenance. I was talking to, I don't know, have you come across the guys, John from Track Good? I should make an intro to you. He's based in Wellington.
Yeah, intro. Yeah.
I'm talking to them yesterday. So they've got this tech platform, uses blockchain technology to help track the provenance of supply chain. So we're claiming that this is a fair trade supply chain or direct trade, and it might not be fair trade certified, so it might be like a direct trade or what have you, or da da da. It's like, yep, we can check the provenance of that, and we have, you know, to a degree, proven that that is the case. And I just said to him the same thing. I think you're right on the cusp of this, because the battleground for the, hey, prove that we're doing good at a company level is kind of all, it's kind of feels like we're in the middle of that battle. The next one is going to be, but where does your stuff actually come from? And what's the manufacturing process?
So, no, I completely agree. And that's, I mean, that, I guess that to explain where BlockTech's name comes from. We, when part of the other piece when we were talking about this is we firmly knew that we would have to do prove provenance, that we'd collected the material and we'd recycled, and the provenance of the raw material that was being sent, because we knew that provenance was really important in those, in the items that you're buying, the provenance of the fiber, the provenance of the fabric, that kind of thing. And then I'd be able to validate the economic and environmental benefit going forward. So we have our own blockchain. That's been something that's been really important to integrate. But I think the other thing to kind of point out as to how we kind of, we've thought about this is that it's a business that can, we can work with the big end in town. So, you know, a lot of our customers are the large laundromats or workwear companies. So we work with any major brand you could think of. We're working with those guys. And so you can provide benefit at the top end of town, but then you go right down the end to the consumer, us every day, who have got our favorite T-shirt that we've loved to death and we can't give to a charitable shop because it has no value. But our only other choice is then to put into landfill. And so we know that that consumers at that base level are looking for those solutions. They expect that either the brands are sorting that out, or at the very least the government sorting that out. And the other way we also provide benefit back into society is when you take something like a garment's different, that everybody's garment is different, it's kind of designed a different way, you did different materials, is a blended fiber, is a single fiber. As I said, we focus on polyester cotton blends. We can do the 100% polyester, 100% cotton. So we can do your favorite nice shirt to hang around the house, or your run shirt when you're playing footy. But when you talk about workwear, they don't have an end-of-life solution because there's often security attached to that. You can't have Air New Zealand pilot uniforms floating around, you know, the beaches of Bali. Right? So you just talk about, so what would normally happen is they get burnt or buried. Right, that's not a great outcome for anyone. And so when those companies want to report their ESG reporting, it's like, what do you do with your clothing? Are we burn them or bury them? It's like, well, that's not a good outcome. And so, but going through BlockTech, you know that we don't use the word destroy. That's a bad word in our language. Mm. We talk about resource recovery or processing, because we're a manufacturing process, and we don't talk about those clothes that we don't want. We don't think of your favorite, you know, grow good T-shirt that's got a hole in it. We don't think of it as waste. We think of that as a feedstock. It's a mindset point of view, right? So it has value to us as value to you.
Yep.
And so when we talk about garments, they've got buttons and zippers and those sorts of things that need to be removed. We've got third-party relationships across what we call the NDI sector, which is our National Disability Income Scheme. So we work directly with disadvantaged and disabled people to help us remove those items. We're a very, very clear relationship in regards to the type of work, their employment conditions. Everybody gets paid, you know, the right supporting wages. We've grown that now from 10 to more than 100 at this present moment. We're also working across three correctional services in Queensland. We work directly with prisoners across those centres. That scheme was initially started as a small trial. It's now grown into three prisons. It'll probably double that in the next 4 months into more prisons. Those prisoners have not only got gainful employment and wages, but also it's a way from gain trust within the hierarchy of the prison system. And so we've had prisoners who have worked with us and are now working in the welding area, gaining their welding ticket so they can go out to get future jobs. And so there's a great opportunity to work through that. They are also now making the cutting room tables for us that we're now moving into our other social impact areas. And we've got some, we've got a big announcement coming up with a very large social impact company that's got a large Australian base to work directly with women who have found themselves in the margins of life. And so for us, this is just a necessary part of what we need to do in business. I could have gone and bought a whole bunch of robots to do this and automated it. But having the opportunity to play in that social impact sector, provide consistent work to areas that require consistent work, and to provide opportunity for future skill sets, and also the opportunity then to move on maybe into, you know, the next lot of block techs employment, because everybody who works for us, they're all new jobs. So we've kind of got this opportunity to start to create these work pathways, whether it be apprenticeships or whether it be specific skill sets that grow from the social impact into a full-time employment. That they're all the jobs that many people said to me, why are you employing people? It's expensive to employ people. Why don't you just get robots? It's like, well, that's not the purpose of the business. It's like, we've got a strong environmental impact, we've got a strong social impact, and those two sit very closely to us. And so the onboarding of the next lot of social partners, they've got really strong social impact, but they want to bring environmental impact into their business. So now what we're seeing is the sharing of those different impacts by combining in a partnership. You get to both share those skill sets, but also that impact across social and environmental, which I think is actually a higher purpose than being regulated by government to meet these mandates as a big company. I think that's the smarter way of thinking about things. And so if you talk about circular economy, we think about waste and change, but we often don't think about value exchange within that circular economy. You could have a circular economy of value exchanges that both companies can then share and release value that they've created either individually or together. And I think that is really easy to do. People think it's difficult, but it's not. You need the willingness of the companies, but also if you're working with companies like B Corps, where you're already kind of starting from the same base, it's not like you're having to retool that business to make it fit within that partnership. So it's a much easier transition. But also I think the value exchange is much greater because you're both coming from the same point of purpose.
Yeah, totally. You sound very, there's another cool company just down here called MedSouth, who based in Christchurch. I'll connect you with Ollie there as well, their CEO. So he does medical product repurposing. So products that typically are single use sent to landfill, takes them, repurpose them. And again, he's got people where he's providing employment opportunities for people with intellectual disability to give them opportunities in mainstream employment. It's just interesting that you're both doing something very similar with a very similar mindset in terms of creating opportunities for people. And I think it's interesting with the whole AI talk and, we're all going to be out of jobs. So it's like, well, if we choose to put us all out of jobs, then yes, but equally we could choose not to put ourselves out of jobs. And what if we created some jobs that had some real meaning and some real purpose and provided opportunities and progression? Isn't that a nicer way to do it? It just seems like the AI rush is for there to be one person at the top of the AI pile who runs everything, who's earning all the money but we're all at home doing nothing. Not quite sure how that all stacks up.
No, I agree. Society is vast. You know, there's so many different layers, and everybody's trying to go, you're A, you're B, you're C. It's not like that. And every time I go and spend time with our decommissioning partners, it's some of the best time of my month. They are enthusiastic about what they're doing. They're often wanting to know what we're doing with materials. The companies that they're the clients of are able to then provide longer term plans in regards to how many clients they can take on, what sort of workspaces, because we're providing a 52-week opportunity as opposed to here's 4 weeks to do one job and then nothing, and then here's 4 weeks to do another job. And then that allows, I think importantly, what doesn't often get realized is these people have carers, and those carers can then go and either do life, go back into the workforce, go back into study. And so there's the secondary and third benefits that are going on. And then you also have able to have a conversation back into the government to show where businesses can really interact within these government supported areas and what the government needs to do to support those government supported areas, so then businesses can take a greater advantage of that opportunity to work. It's incredibly rewarding, and look, it's not always perfect because life isn't perfect.
Yep.
But we've had great experiences with all our social impact partners to date, and I don't want that to change. And I think there's opportunities now. We're talking about how do we bring some of those partners or some of those clients into our facility, because they've actually gained a whole bunch of knowledge about textiles and how textiles behave that we could actually utilize fully into our facility.
It was the same because we were talking to you when I was hanging out. I did a contract with Kilmarnock Enterprises down here. We were sort of scheming. I think it was just it would have been just before COVID.
Just before COVID, yeah.
Yeah, and you were kind of like, oh, is it maybe easier to launch this thing in New Zealand than Aussie, maybe? And I was trying to tempt you over the ditch. And if people want to have an experience of what connecting to social impact could look like in your business, just go and ring the team at Kilmarnock Enterprises. Mm-hmm. Or if you're in Auckland, there's Altus Enterprises. If there's all over the world, you know, wherever you're listening, there are these enterprises where they're trying to help people. And in many ways, I think it is fair to say that people with disability, and particularly those with intellectual disability, are at the furthest margins of society, because the education system is just not catered for their needs whatsoever. I think something like 90% of inmates have got undiagnosed either intellectual disability or dyslexia or some kind of communication issue. Mm-hmm. And that is just a really interesting stat to reflect on, that, you know, that's how marginalized some of these people are. But with a tiny bit of care, coaching, and some love and attention, they can be fully brought into a mainstream life. And seeing that in action, I think people listen to go, oh yeah, sure, it sounds great, yeah, whatever. But actually go into one of these places and meet these people and see the difference that having a job makes to someone's life.
Absolutely.
And I think that's really, like I say, when you kind of go, everyone kind of going, oh, actually, I'm quite happy for the robot to have my job. Although my theory is that the robots will take all our jobs, and then after a day, they'll go, hang on, these jobs are shit. You can come back and do your jobs. We're going down the pub.
No, I agree. I think it's the other layers of, like, that we all get from the workforce. It's the social interaction. It's a sharing of your time with another human being, and all those different layers that you don't get. You have your own relationship at home with your family, and then you have your kind of your work life relationship, and you're not different people, but it's different experiences, and it's the same whether you're able-bodied or non-able-bodied or whatever your situation is. And this is really important, but your point about even if somebody's tripped or find themselves in the margins, doesn't mean that that's where they should have to stay. And businesses, if you have the opportunity as a business to help one person or 10 people, 100 people, then I think that's part of the social purpose of a business, right? And so I don't think that's not a nice to have. That is just part of how you operate the business. And so it was been a really interesting, like I said, it's been a great experience for us. It hasn't always been easy. Nothing is ever perfect. And we've had to work really closely with that. And there's been some social impact partners who have come and gone because our value we were offering to them didn't quite fit the value that they were trying to offer to their clients. And so that's all part of understanding where you go from there. But, you know, we're getting better at delivering our value to those partners, and we're getting better with understanding what those partners need from us. And so we just keep evolving from that point of view. But everybody, whether it's the managers or the state government or the prison, the correctional services, all of the people who are decision makers have done all they can do to open doors. They've pushed through bureaucracy, got rid of red tape. It's just like, how do we make this happen? And every time we want to expand capacity, great. In fact, they're the ones saying to us, we want to do more. Can you not get more? Can we want to do more? And so as we scale, we're going to have a great opportunity to take over that capacity. So that's been a good experience. So we have to check back in 12 months and I'll see how we're going.
100%. But I think it's just testament to the compelling vision and purpose that you have in your organization. It's, I think I've mentioned this a few times recently. You know, it's the easy and obvious path to kind of get angry that the fact that the world isn't perfect and we should be doing things better. But people don't want to hang out with those people. But what you've done and what a bunch of our other guests are all about is, okay, yeah, we get that this can be better, but we're actually just going to roll up our sleeves and give it a bloody good nudge and create this compelling vision that's almost like obvious in terms of its purpose and contribution, that people can just look at it. And if it vibes with them, they're just like, actually, I want to be a part of this because this is cool. And I think that's the key to anyone who's like thinking about starting an impact purpose, you know, sustainably focused business is don't be angry with it. For me, I always say it's about having the best party on the street. Just be having a house party that everyone on the street's going, hang on a minute, that sounds really fun. Like everyone's laughing and they've got free beers and wines and, you know, they're drinking responsibly, obviously, but you know, they're having a great time. And I think it's clear that's what you've done. So go you.
No, thanks. You've got to find people who believe in you, but you've got to turn up every day. You've got to turn up with the passion. I can't have an 8 out of 10 day. It's got to be 10 out of 10 every day. Now, that's not always easy, but everybody else in the business who was working really hard for this to be success are turning up. And so you've got to be in there and be the Pied Piper. Mm-hmm. You've got to be the visionary. You can't get stuck in the bits that don't work. By its very nature, manufacturing doesn't work. There's times when machines break down or it doesn't quite join together. Or, you know, the truck breaks down bringing the feedstock or 1,000 things. I mean, as we start to scale this business, we really only turned on the taps March and April this year. So we're really starting to scale up our manufacturing. But I'm going to need 45,000 garments per day when this plant is running. 45,000. That's at our 4,000 ton per annum stage one. We're already building stage two within the factory, and that will take us to 10,000 tons of processing per year. And we'll need 115,000 garments per day, day on day on day. So the logistics of that is incredible. So all the stuff that happens in regards to gathering up our garments, logistically picking them up, getting them to the decommissioning partners, getting them to the shredding company, and then getting it to our factory, because I can't store all that stuff on site. I've only got limited capacity, is a whole business in itself. And we've had to build that itself. We're the only company in the world that is handling a full end-to-end ecosystem where we collect from the clients, we do all the preparation before the processing, we process and then we create our two raw materials of recycled PET pellets and cellulose clay. And so, you know, I can't just ignore one part of the business at the detriment of another part of the business. So every day there's something that is not quite where we'd like it to be, or we've got to work harder, or we've got to think, but I've also got to be thinking about, you know, is the second factory in New Zealand, which is what we're already thinking about now. What does that look like? Engaging stakeholders. We're over there in Auckland early this month. Great meetings with the government, great meetings with stakeholders across the region. Now we've got to do the roadwork to say, well, how much textile waste is there in the country? What's the appetite? Is the people who want to support us? The government want to support us? The industry want to support us? The consumers want to support us? And then most importantly, for the raw material that we manufacture, is there customers? Do people want to buy recycled material? I don't have them at the moment, but we've got a variety of, own branded products, from coat hangers to sunglasses to all sorts of things that were once clothing. And these are all brand new products coming to the market, which are incredibly exciting. But you need to find customers to buy that. So over and above all the wonderful effort we've done from building a great business and the science point of view, this is where the rest of society has to back things and say, hang on, I really believe in the planet. Why am I buying something that is a virgin material when I can be buying recycled material that's the same quality? Mm-hmm. And so we as consumers have the greatest amount of power. I think we undervalue that, right? We kind of get caught 100%. By buying it from so. It's like we can make a decision. If you want a brand to change the way they behave, then tell them that, or go and buy from the B Corp who really prioritizes environment and sensation. It's a really simple process. So simple. I guarantee you, industry changes so fast.
I was listening to a podcast last night and they were talking about this, like how do you create societal change? And they said fundamentally it comes down to changing what we value. And it is as simple as that. It's like if we value new, untarnished, unblemished, you know, then people will seek new. So maybe you do need to get onto your TikTok and your Twitter book and all the rest of it and get your influencers. hey, look at me with my recycled sunglasses. Aren't I sexy and exciting?
I might get some of the younger team to do that.
Have you do you know Paul Frasca from Sustainable
No.
Salons? I should introduce you to him.
Ah, no, I think I have met him a long time ago. Yes. He's done
But
great work in that space.
yeah, so he was my last interviewee, whether it comes out sequentially to be confirmed. But a couple of things he mentioned. He called what you guys are doing above ground mining. And I thought that was such a cool phrase. He said, you know, give me the most die hard. I just want to make as much money as possible. And he's like, look, I'm not a greenie. I'm into mining just like you are, but I'm above ground mining. I'm taking all the dirt and all the crap that people have left behind, and I'm mining that to make good money and make a difference. And he said that was a real key way of shifting, particularly, you know, more sort of center right to right leaning people who weren't like, oh, you're recycling hair and plastic bottles. Ugh. He's like, no, I'm above ground miner. So I thought that was pretty cool. And I think, yeah, you know, very similarly, again, they've just launched a range of products from some of their recycled materials and stuff as well. So it's all going pretty good. So like, how did you even get into all this to begin with? So like the media stuff. But so, you know, young Graham growing up, were you always picking up, you know, stuff on the streets, waste, and putting it in the bin and trying to, you know, did you have your own recycle? Were you picking up the aluminium cans or the bottles and taking them to the bottle shop and getting the 5 cents back or whatever back in the day? Or yeah, how did you
No,
get
like I
into all
can't
this?
claim any of that good living or being the right thing. So I was incredibly distracted at school. I didn't like authority. I didn't like to go to school. It was boring, and so I mean, I got through in my education, but I always wanted to. There was other things to do. I wanted to be entertained. I had a strong curiosity. I didn't find that at school, and so I moved. We had a local television station, and I wanted to go and work there. It took me nearly 2 years after leaving school of basically annoying them nearly every day, to the point I was playing on the indoor cricket team. Right, eventually a job came up, and they said, "Do you want it?" It's like, yes. So
My plan has worked.
that was great, because television gave me, like I said before, gave me a great understanding of a whole lot of not only from a technology point of view, but also from understanding topics. And so I went through a period of I did all the production, so cameraman, studio director, did outside broadcasts, editing. Eventually found myself moving from my country town in Queensland down into the big city in Brisbane, and I worked there in the news department. So that gave me an understanding of what it looked like to work in a large news gathering organization. And it was important that deadlines. So, if you promise to do something, then the news starts at 6 p.m. It doesn't start at 6:01, right? So it had to be done by that point of view. And then I moved to Sydney, where I started working on the lifestyle channels and the lifestyle programs during the 90s. And then I think that's where my first opportunity. I mean, my job change between Brisbane and Sydney was, I mentioned to somebody, "Do you know anybody in Sydney? Because I want to change." And they said yes. They rang somebody up, and they said, that was Wednesday. They said, "Oh, I'm on holidays, but I'm back in the office on Friday. Can you come down?" So I flew down on the Friday and I did half a day's work with them. And then I was back. I took a job that was back there in 2 weeks, which is kind of how my life has kind of rolled. There's not a lot of deep thinking about stuff. Is this an opportunity? Let's crack on. And so, but what I said, opportunities where television was making a fundamental change from using videotape to using computers. And I saw that happening. I fundamentally saw that there was going to be an industry shift. And when I look back, I can kind of see that that's kind of not necessarily a superpower, but it's certainly where I positioned myself in my work career. And I was able to get some training on these new computers that made television. And then I was able to buy the first one of the PC based into the country. And then that industry took off, and that's pretty much how we do it. I mean, I can edit television on my phone these days,
Yeah,
but
it's insane.
I remember, but there's always an element of risk. I mean, we just had our second daughter. She was only a few months old. And I remember sitting at our kitchen table writing out a loan agreement for $163,000 for a computer, which is effectively a Mac
Bloody
with some
hell.
software. Right, and 27 gigabyte of hard drive, and I paid $1,000 a gigabyte. Right, so we,
You imagine the sales guy going, I bloody sold one.
oh
I
no,
sold
yeah. And I said, my wife of more than 25 years just look at me. It's like, okay, so But we actually owed more on that computer. I mean, how's this for a mine mess? We owed more for that computer than we owed on our home mortgage.
Should have bought 10 of
So,
them. Yeah.
but then I think this is the other thing when you kind of think about entrepreneurs, everybody kind of thinks, oh, you start off and away you go. I remember I had to design the suite. I'd rented a room in another production facility. We'd painted the walls ourselves, with my daughter lying on the floor, kind of rolling around the mat because she could hardly lift her head up off the ground. And for the first month, I sat there and stared at those walls because I had no business. Until a friend of mine said she had a nail tech she had a nail salon, and she said, "I'd like to do a video about what I do." And so that was my first thing I did. I did a video for a friend of mine for a nail salon, and from there, we bought many suites and many computers, and had lots of employees, and that culminated with then moving with a couple of partners. We had one of Australia's largest independent production companies. We had 65 full-time staff,
Wow.
making primetime TV across Australia. We work for Nat Geo, Animal Planet, and Discovery internationally. It was great. And that was all going swimmingly well until my wife had the wonderful opportunity to move to Singapore to take up an Asia Pacific role with the international company she was working for. And so I sold out of the business and we packed up the kids and we went to Singapore for a bit over 4 years. And during that time, I dabbled in a whole bunch of things, but I started to triathlons and marathons and kind of tried to get myself from being a large overweight television executive who spent more time at lunches and
Nice.
after dinner drinks than he did exercising. Eventually we end up in London where my wife took an international role, and I had the great opportunity to play Mr. Mum or be the support for her and also the kids while they were going through school. And that was an incredible opportunity. But I was also doing a bunch of this exercise, and by the time I got to London, I'd done a bunch of races. And if you ever do a race, you get a free T-shirt, and so they were great. You'd put on after the event, and you'd wear it home on the plane, so everybody knew you'd done the event. But any other time, you wouldn't wear it because they didn't feel very nice when you put them on. If you wore them for a couple of hours, it smelled like it'd been lost in a dog box for the last month or so. And so my business head got on me and said, "Well, I'm racing with thousands of people, and so these sponsors aren't getting any more exposure than sort of after the race, and it should be ongoing." So, what if I could make something that made people was better to wear and people wouldn't wear them? And so, I again back into the TV mind, did a lot of research, and I found that the clothes that I wear and that you wear and everybody wears were actually not great from an environmental point of view. As I said, polyester is a fossil fuel based material, and it doesn't degrade, not for a very long time. And cotton, depending on where it's grown, can use an awful lot of water and an awful lot of pesticides. And so that didn't make sense to me, given that you kind of thought that my clothes shouldn't feel like they're killing me or the planet. And so
Well, especially when you're
over
doing it in a thing that's about health and fitness and
yeah,
vitality and being vigorous. Yeah, it's
absolutely.
as a good mate of mine, Dave, Canadian Dave, he always said he always found it quite ironic that in New Zealand, probably the same in Aussie, you do a marathon and at the end they have a sausage sizzle with the worst piece of
Yes.
meat in the worst piece of sliced bread with some ketchup on it. It's like, but I suppose, well, you just run a marathon so you can have a crap sausage into bread. But
Well,
yeah.
that's exactly right. No, I completely agree. So I did a lot of research, and then I worked out that there were fibers, and they're really early, and people, there wasn't a lot of, just like you're saying, people knew that they were a better fiber or better for the environment, but nobody was buying them because there just wasn't the uptake or the interest. And so I made a few phone calls, and with no background in the fashion and textile industry, I managed to persuade a bunch of companies to provide me with some fibers, and then I then had to kind of go, okay, what do I do with that? And so I literally had to look up, how do you make fibers? How do you make fabrics? Like, how does the industry work? And so I ended up finding a facility in a spinning mill in Korea, and I called them up and I said, "I've got all these fibers you've never heard of, but I want to make some fabric." And so over an 18-month period, we made four fabrics, three natural plant-based and one with a kind of a new wave polyester that you could break down. Then I had to find someone who cared. So we did a Kickstarter campaign and we called it the greenest t-shirt on the planet. And the blend of fibers we used meant that we used about 1% of what it would normally, the water you would use to make a normal cotton t-shirt. So that gave us an in for people who cared about things. And so We successfully funded the Kickstarter, which meant I could kind of go, okay, well, there is people out there in the world who really care that like I care. And then we proceeded to make a range of sportswear tops and launched our sportswear company called Casaga Athletic. And that kind of got me on the journey of really understanding the industry. And we, you know, I would all my manufacturing in Asia, I would actually go there and sit on the floor. I'd get them to take me around the factory. I'd get them to explain to me how things would work. And everyone was really, really generous. But you kind of find these really, really bizarre experiences, right? You're going, okay, you've got this, you believe that these big industries have got it all nutted out, but they kind of have and they kind of haven't, right? And so there's points where I walked around this testing area and there was two washing machines, and one said Adidas and one said Nike. And I said, then what are they for? They said, oh, they're the washing machines for Adidas and Nike. And I said, why? I said, that's how we do the color fast test. So, you know, that's the magic, right? You put in a washing machine 10 or 12 times, it's like if it comes out the right color, crack
We're
on.
good.
Yeah. So these are really interesting things that I've then taken into this next stage of business. But it's been an incredible experience to go from making television, and especially when we were living in Singapore, I was working for Discovery and making documentaries across the Asian region, indigenous documentaries, which is incredibly humbling when you're trying to make a program in a language you don't actually can't speak or understand. But you're there to support the emerging television industry there as part of that initiative through Discovery and through the government. To find yourself sitting on a floor with a swatch pack, deciding on, you know, what shade of green or red you want for your garment, and you're kind of going, and then you're having conversations where they're talking about, you know, design and neck lathe, and then you come back to Australia, and I was working with a designer here, and I was putting the shirts on, and I'd go for a run for 500 meters, come back, say adjust this, adjust this. Then I'd go for a run for 5 Ks, come back, go adjust this, adjust that. Go for a run for 20 Ks, come back, and go right. All those kind of layers, which is essentially what we've done here in Blocktex, but I had to physically do that myself, and that in itself has been a great learning curve. And it's exactly what most entrepreneurs do. It's the stuff that you've done. You have to go out and do your own roadwork to really understand. Do you 100% yourself believe in the mission that you've set yourself on? Because if you don't, stop now, because it's too bloody hard. If you don't wake up every morning with your tummy aching to get to work to make this happen, don't do it, because it's not the right business for you. There'll be another one, but if it doesn't make you jump out of bed every day, even when you're completely exhausted and you're not being the best husband or the best father or the best business partner, don't do it, because it's as equally wonderfully to achieve it, but it's equally really hard to live a life like this every day if you don't believe in that.
100% agree. It's been an interesting almost 8 years in business. What is that, right? 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. Yeah, 8 years. Pretty much actually 8 years. I wouldn't, if I didn't believe in what I was doing, I would have given up probably 7.5 years ago.
Yeah,
That's
no,
for
I agree.
sure.
And like you said before, it's like then you come up with these ideas, but then where does purpose, how do you get purpose into that? Where does that kind of meld itself? And one of the things, and we talked about it before, one of the things I did from the business, because I knew that environmentally it was the right thing to do, but also I knew people cared, but they didn't quite understand how they could care. And I also didn't, I'd never run a business that had a fundamentally was based around environmental impact. And so that was when I discovered B Corp and the opportunity to understand that there was actually a framework for me to set up a business from the start, that I could get for free for a start. But then if I chose to then certify, then I knew that I was going to belong to a community. And I was one of the early companies in Australia. And Casaga went on to be, you know, best in the world for first 4 years. Until we'd kind of I kind of transitioned into working at Blocktex. But the B Corp gave me the opportunity to, yeah, set up that framework to have some learnings for those who have gone before me, but then also that, like, you know, to meet people like yourself and across the world to just hear their stories and to learn from how they maybe what they're encountering. And I think importantly, How do you articulate what you're trying to achieve on a brand level, but then also importantly back down into your staff level and then into your customer level? So all those things have been really important. And whilst Blocktex is not a big corporate at this present moment, that's certainly part of the journey going forward. But we've got some other critical pieces, namely chemistry and advanced manufacturing, to get aligned first before we layer that opportunity on us. But we've already got the social impact already embedded into the business model.
Yeah, a smart decision, I think. You know, people often ask us, oh, you know, when should we look at doing B Corp? Startups, yeah, definitely worth looking at it when you're a startup, so long as you've got the bandwidth and don't let. Yeah. And I think you're a classic example of, like, yeah, if you put the focus and attention on B Corp right now, it would take you off the prize of actually getting to the next, like getting to that next ledge that you need to get to. And I think, don't, it's everything's a balancing act. There's no black and whites. It's gray. Don't let the certification get in the way of the long-term success of the business. And I think there's a few examples of companies that I've seen where, yeah, they've really tried to prioritize the social impact or the environmental impact, but they haven't actually had the sustainable business in the background to enable that. And you need to have that sustainable business. Yeah. So yeah, I have no qualms. And like I say, from what you're doing and from what you know of the B Corp assessment, you'd be smashing a bunch of environmental impact business models and a bunch of community, worker impact business models. So yeah, you would easily be, what would you reckon? I think you'd probably be about a 110, 120 B Corp. Easy.
I think that's a really important point. Like I said, B Corp gives you the tools for free. Whether you certify is up to you, but the most important thing is that you behave like a B Corp, whether you're certified or not. And so if you can behave like a B Corp, and then when the timing is right, then do your certification, well, then that makes complete sense. You already achieved so much. So many companies, like I encountered as well, they said, oh, I've got to be a B Corp, and they set this time frame and they smashed into it, and the whole experience was lost. And they might have become B Corps, but the effort to become B Corp far outweighed the journey and the reason you're doing it. And I think it should be something that's part of your journey, not the ultimate end goal. And so if you're not incorporating those foundations as you're going, a certification is not going to make you operate a certain way, right?
Yeah, it's like a better business. Yeah, no, totally. It's got to be baked in. It's got to be part of the DNA. Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah. So when did you certify as a B Corp with Kasaga?
2017, I believe.
Oh, yeah, so pretty early in the piece. And when did you start the business?
About the same time.
Okay, so yeah, pretty much as soon as you could, you got it.
Yeah. So I knew that's what we needed to do. And like I said, the framework was there. And it wasn't overly difficult because I didn't have a very complex business, so there was only me, and I knew directly my supply chain. You know, I was in their living rooms having dinner, so I could trace all that kind of stuff, and then we could validate stuff. And we only had a small inventory, so that was all pretty quick. Nice. So 2017. God, the days. No, it must have been earlier than that.
It might be. I was going to say because I certified 2016. And we were number six in New Zealand, but New Zealand was, so maybe, yeah, maybe, you
know, who knows? 23, so no, it has to be early because Blocktex was as my, I'm going to blame it on the travel, 17 days this month so far. We certified in, Blocktex was formed in 2018, so it must be 4 years, so it must be more like 2012 or 13.
Yeah, that would ring a bell, yeah, because... Yeah. Eagle Protect B Corp number one. I'm pretty sure they were 2012. They're B Corp number one in New Zealand. So yeah, that would ring more true. Someone can fact check it and let both of us know, maybe. Time flies, man. Time flies.
Exactly.
When you're trying to change the world.
I'm gonna. Yeah, it's either jet lag or there's lots of balls I'm juggling.
Lots of juggling. Yeah. And so the crowdfunding, how did that go? Any top tips for crowdfunding? Because
Oh,
there's been
wow.
quite a few B Corps that have done okay with crowdfunding. Etique over here, they've done it twice, really successfully. Who's the other one? Well, Kickstarter themselves, I think they are still a B Corp, so that the one of the crowdfunding platforms is themselves a B Corp. But yeah, thoughts, would you do it again? Yeah, top tips for anyone thinking about it.
It's really matured since we did the Greenest T-shirt on the Planet campaign. And I think for businesses at any stage, if you've got a product that you think might go like have value into the community, where people are really going to get value out of, like not only contributing to your success, your growth, but also you're able to provide things. So often craft breweries do very well because you can get a discount on your beer that's ongoing. So but also that's really important because you've got that continual touch point. And I think that's really important for businesses. We looked at it from a BlockTech's point of view. The challenge we'd face is that we've got manufacturing equipment, right? So I've got a piece of equipment that's worth more than $1 million. So yeah, you don't get a lot for your dollars in the advanced manufacturing point of view. And also I think there's certain types of business they really suit. For us, for Kasaga, like I said, it gave us, we didn't do it for the money. We did it to understand whether anybody cared. But it was a great way to you had to then create a whole bunch of collateral. So you had to understand what your key message was. How do you articulate your mission statement? How are you describing the value you might be providing in the product? It made you work on who your target market is. It was literally, my wife's got a background in media, I've got a background in media, but we worked full on for a month driving that campaign. It was hard work, right? You have that initial sort of 1 to 4 days where all your friends and family tip in and everybody's kind of getting involved, and then it starts to trail off and trail off. And I think what we're seeing now with the crowdfunding campaigns is they've got a probably a 6 week lead into that launch. So it's already well established in the marketplace, but then also there's a whole media campaign that kind of plays out during that raise. And I think that's really smart. So the more you can preempt your launch is really important, but then you also got to make sure you've got continual stuff to keep people involved. Because somebody said to me one day, they said, we were discussing this, they said, "Well, Graham, you need to remember, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to go and fund a Kickstarter campaign today, right? Yeah, there's got to be a reason." And I've got to say, I know some of our friends who we were catching up during that month, they're saying, "Oh yeah, I'm going to contribute. I'm going to contribute. I want to get a couple of shirts." And literally they're like buying in the last hour because they've got, "Oh, I meant to do that," right? So we're all guilty of it. And so you can't rely on your friends and families to drag you along. You have to go out and actually find that market that you think you can sell your product to. So I think these things can be quite, I think there's two ways it can play out. It can be really well directed and marketed, and it can be a success. But that doesn't guarantee that's a successful business, because you can do that and not actually know that you've garnered the right people who are going to buy it. Because it might be people who go, "This is kind of cool, I'm going to get in there," but they may never buy another product off you. So I think the most important thing is do all that hard work, but make sure you absolutely know that the people who are coming on board, that you're talking to the right market segment, that you can then sell product into that market segment for years to come. Because then that's how you have a sustainable business. So there's a re reality to everything that we all face, and I know you faced it yourself, where you have to look in that mirror and go, am I a success, or am I not necessarily a failure, or what am I pretending not to know? Am I telling myself something that isn't true because I want it to be true? Because just because you want it to be true doesn't mean it's actually true. So I think that's one of the real hard things about being an entrepreneur, is that you are constantly analyzing and doubting and trying to work out, are you making the right decision? Is this the right thing for you? Should I be doing this? Does anybody care? There's times with my business partner, I often go, "Is it just us in the world that care about this?" But we know that's not true, right? There's plenty of people who care about this, and I think we've picked the right place, because clothing is something that we all wear. It's something that allows us to identify who we are. It's something that allows us to identify into whether it's our ethnic group, our country group, whether it's our local football group. Like, it's defining, but also it allows us to then to express ourselves. And so none of us want those clothes that we love and we love to death to end up hurting the planet that we're living on. And so what we do expect as consumers, we expect that somebody is solving that problem, and that somebody is the industry that's making it, and it's the government that's making sure that the industry is doing the right thing by the environment. And then hopefully there's a couple of, like I said, a couple of grey-haired entrepreneurs who are going, hey, we'll have a crack at that. Just come and support us and we'll get going. But because no communities are going. I mean, for instance, here in Australia, we haven't got to New Zealand. I'd love to bring it to New Zealand. We're doing a linen collection, day linen collection campaign with local councils, because local councils here in Australia bear the brunt of landfill. So everything that's going to landfill, the local councils have to manage. And so they're looking to reduce landfill. Now in Australia, the average linen cupboard holds about 10 kilograms worth of linen. So I don't know what your linen cupboard's like, Tim, but you know, some people have got linen for the last 20 years. They just didn't want to throw out. They've never had the opportunity. So we do effectively a linen drive, and we call it give a sheet for the planet.
Nice.
See what I've done there. So we've just completed our 12th or 13th. The numbers are, I just had the numbers before. We've collected nearly 30,000 kilograms of unwanted linen, which equates to an offset of nearly 900,000 CO2 equivalents. So it's a massive opportunity from that point of view. But what it also does, it gives the community an opportunity to turn up and drop out. So over a 6-hour period on our last event a week ago, we had 250 cars. That's 40 cars an hour.
Wow.
It's a busy time. And so that engagement is continuing. We're starting to grow that brand here in Australia. And I'd like to think that that is going to become at least a monthly event, if not a bi-monthly event, and then have the opportunity to start to bring that to New Zealand, because not only is it a good thing from the environment and from landfill diversion, but they're a lot of fun. Everybody turns up and has a big giggle.
It sounds like you have a bit of fun with that one. I like your sort of thoughts around the crowdfunding, because I guess if you do a crowdfunding and it fails, as in you don't meet the money, you've at least had possibly enough exposure to get
Absolutely.
Enough customers to kind of get you going. I also like the thought of the fact that it's kind of like, hey, Dave and Sally, I know you said you were going to buy one, but you do know that I can actually see who has bought one.
I know. There's no formalities. You ring people up. So I thought you'd buy a T-shirt. Come on, I need to get to my target. But you're right with that database. I engage with that database. And so I would call people up and say, what do you think of the shirt? Would you like different colors? How's the size fit? What motivates you? So you have this direct. So I was doing that during the campaign, because that was just free advertising, free marketing, free design knowledge to say, you know, what made you buy this? And then I wrote all that sort of stuff. And then you start to look at what are the consistent themes you're getting back. So what do people like about it? What people don't like about it? And the areas where they told you the bits they didn't like about it were better than the bits they like, because you can fix it. Yeah, absolutely. You're exactly right. For that reason alone, if you want to spend the time, it is such a good value. It's better than going spending money on, a third-party consultancy is going to cost you, $50,000 to tell you what you could have done for nothing.
Yeah. And it's that whole, like when Richard Branson launched Virgin Airlines, he flew on as many British Airways flights as he could, different routes, different classes. And he just turned to the person next to him and said, what's the five things you like and don't like about this, about your trip so far? And he collated that list and said, right, when we build an airline, it has to have this and we don't do any of this.
Yeah.
It's
absolutely,
it's so shockingly simple sometimes, isn't it?
We just think it's like I said before.
Well, it's got to be more complicated than this.
No, it's the roadwork. You've got to do the roadwork, and the roadwork's really hard, because you've got to take your ego and you've got to put it so far down the pockets of your pants, and you just got to accept what people are going to say to you. Right. And you're not going to judge them. You can't come with any opinions. Just go, well, what do you like? What do you not like? Because that's what makes the world a wonderful place, is that we're all actually different. And if we're all the same, that would make a very boring place. But also there's times when people tell you what they think, you kind of go, well, I don't agree with that. But that's not for you to agree on, disagree. Because if that's your customer, you've got to give them what they want. So,
Although with my sales training hat on, we sort of say the customer's not always right, but they are the customer. So you might not believe they're right, but that's their opinion. And yeah. But I think it's like, I think business and launching business, and particularly edgy, you know, you've clearly had, like, I think you and I are quite similar in that we like edgy new things. Like, it's me buying a computer for some ridiculous amount of money when it's just been launched. Like, not everyone's doing that. But I think it's, you know, business and stuff like that is it's often like good comedy. It's all in the timing. And, you know, Kusaga, you were clearly ahead of the curve in terms of socially and environmentally responsible sportswear or just clothing in general to that level. And then what you're doing now, it's kind of like, you know, you're just ahead of the curve, but I think you're probably slightly better at the curve. I was like 8 years ahead of the curve with the whole B Corp thing. So what do I know? But yeah, I think it's hard to get it exactly right. And I think sometimes, well, again, listen to a couple of other podcasts, you know, I listen to a lot of other podcasts. For me, I think fundamentally life is about struggle. And if you didn't have the struggle, if you didn't have the tough times, like if you and Adrian had written down on some stuff on a piece of paper, there happened to be a chemist sitting next to you, like, oh yeah, I could whip that up this afternoon. And your whole factory had been a success the next day. It wouldn't be as much, looking back, I don't think it would be as satisfying and as much fun, where you've had a lot of tribulations and trials, COVID, trying to get funding. I don't know. I just kind of feel like, for whatever reason, humanity is built around the idea that there needs to be some struggle in it. Yeah. Otherwise, it's not worth doing.
Yeah, you got to have a little bit of suffer in there. And sometimes you don't want to admit that. But I think what I've taken out of this business is people. If people believe in something, then you get so much support, right? So you got to identify that. So understanding how do you influence people to not only realize the knowledge that they have that they can share to provide that value back to you, but then how do you harness them all together to kind of go and know that they're only on that journey for a period of time and they're happy to help us. So it's kind of like we're like a tram moving through a city and people get on and get off, get on and get off, right? And when they're on, they're part of the tram, part of the journey, and then they get off because that was their time. They didn't need to be anymore. But what we get from the people we've worked with is constant support or calling us out on social media or whatever. Good, great to see you there. And it's you know, they're all part of the DNA of our business. And then the other thing is the relationship Adrian and I have developed as business partners has been phenomenal. I've had a few business partners in my time. Him and I have learned how to work together. We're both completely impatient, completely driven, unreasonable individuals with a lot of passion. And we've learned how to work together as equals and supporting, but then also be able to then drive and bring on to us those really key technical pieces. Mm-hmm. But you bring those key technical staff onto the business, they're already here because they've got a passion for it, but then you've got to integrate their skill sets within an organization that is evolving together forward. And that, I think, sometimes that struggle is equally as challenging as a piece of equipment that isn't quite working the way you want it to work. But what I've seen my team grow from in the last 18 months, where they've actually created businesses that didn't exist. They've integrated the social impact partners, the integrated logistics where we've got product going out to customers. On top of all that, is phenomenal. Just watching them grow and really own their business units has been incredibly satisfying. And the struggles of sitting down and forcing them to write operational plans and to meet deadlines and meet milestones and be accountable, all of that's worth it just to watch them stand up and be able to now stand up in front of audiences and talk about what they do as a business and watch them grow as human beings has been incredibly rewarding. We've all got a lot to go, and they helped me learn about, you know, about how I am. You know, it's like it's not always my ways and the ways right, and that might be a bit hard to swallow sometimes. But I'm learning.
It's tough when it's your business and you've built it from the ground up. You know, you've taken paths that you believe were the right path at the time that might have been the right path at the time, but might not be the right way of doing it now. Yeah. So, yeah. And then there's the ego side of it, and oh, it's my baby. I don't want to relinquish. You know, it's kind of my little kid, and you're the new nanny or the babysitter, and all of that stuff. And so, do you and Adrian complement each other? Have you got complementary skill sets, or are you Yeah. So, because you sort of mentioned you're like the visionary. Is he more of the doer type sort of relationship, or?
I think we fluctuate both before. I think because I've always been an entrepreneur. I guess I bring that level of kind of certainly positivity, drive. He brings equally, drive and positivity, but he's also got. He's got a whole. He was a CEO of running one of his companies with 300 or 400 people. So he's got that with a real corporate structure and understanding how to kind of navigate that. And I might be a bit more free thinking in regards to things, but also, I've spent most of the time since we opened the factory. I've been here pretty much every day. I'm the longest standing person that's been here since we started. So I've gained a whole lot of technical knowledge and I guess operational execution, which I think I've brought on from my other businesses. And then Adrian's got a great mind in regards to, legal, financial, those kind of things of that kind of, but we also, we swap backwards and forwards where we need to. What we do have is a great respect for each other, I guess, because we're a little bit older. We've both stubbed our toes in relationships and business relationships over the years. We've got a great respect for each other, but we're also, I guess it's like a marriage, right? There's a time where, mummy and daddy have a conversation in the bedroom that is apart from the kids, and we have a lot of those conversations, really open conversations. And then when the decision's made, then that's the decision made. It's never turned around outside. And I think that's really important.
Something united front in front of the kids.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can make a decision to change that, but you make that together. You don't just make that as a single person. That would never happen in our business. And that gives the team consistency, because it's not easy to work for an entrepreneur, and it's even harder to work for two. Right. So,
I would hazard it's not double, it's possibly exponential.
There's a factor of 10. And I think we have different delivery styles. We present differently. We have different delivery styles within meetings. And at times he may lead, or at times I may lead, depending on what is important. But equally, we support each other with whatever direction we're having. And so, but for the team, we're working really hard lately just to making sure that there's a real clear messaging coming from us down through the layers as the layers grow. We've now got 15 full-time staff, which is still quite a small organization, but they're 15 really critical individuals, because everybody's decision every day makes an impact on the business. Mm-hmm. And so, we're 15 now, we'll be 100 pretty quickly. Like that, it will just scale like that. Once we've got to a point where the factory is working the way we particularly want it to be working, and we've got the right sales orders and stuff like that, then we'll get to that 100, it will just go pop. So we have to make sure we've set up those clear responsibilities and those clear structure within the business that people get access to us. We're a very flat structure. We don't call ourselves CEOs. We're co-founders. That's who we are. I can spend just as much time driving. I've got a forklift license, so I can go and drive the forklift if I need to, or I can go and sit in the laboratory with the scientists and have those kind of conversations. And the team needs to know that, but equally they also need to know that there's a direct report for them to work with, and they don't always have to come to us. And so we also have to be really hands-on and really hands-off, which is really, it's probably the greatest challenge of anybody running a business.
Mm. And I guess also over time maintaining the culture and the purpose and the meaning, but of also recognizing that the culture of a sort of slick startup with just two or three of you, it doesn't support a company of 100 people. And it's funny you mentioned that sort of being able to do all things. I remember my first job in New Zealand was with a company called Synthes, if you were feeling particularly Swiss. And I'd come from the UK working for Johnson & Johnson, where, 80,000 employees, you are just a number in a cog. And John Meek, shout out to Meeky, he was the general manager or country manager who hired me. And he was like, "Oh, do you fancy some lunch, Jonesy?" And I was like, "Sure." And so he went out and got a couple of pies from the BP station. And he said, "Oh, come and give us a hand in the warehouse just to pack some stuff together." And he just turned around and said, "I bet you never had lunch with the country manager of Johnson & Johnson in the warehouse, did you?" I was like, "Oh, you're right, I didn't." And I think that suited that kind of vibe suited my style more, rather than being in this large organization where you kind of don't look at the general manager as he walks past in case you turn to stone. So I think it's cool when the bosses can get their hands dirty, roll the sleeves up and what have you. Oh, well, yeah. So you've got some more exciting times coming up by the sounds of it. So yeah, what does the future look like? So you sort of mentioned New Zealand might be getting a bit of BlockTech action in the future, and then what beyond that, global domination?
Oh, absolutely. The full cape, let's go. Now, when you've got 140 million tons of textiles going to landfill each year, somebody has to come up with some solution, right? We can't just ignore that because that is a significant impact on the environment. We've never thought of Adrian and Graham being the, owning 100 factories across the world. So eventually our goal is that we license this technology around the world. So, it can go to the places where the problem is, as opposed to shipping it to Australia. There's some baby steps to go around from there. It's like, so this is the world's first commercial scale textile resource recovery facility. It's 4,000 tons, it'll be 10,000 tons by early next year. That's fantastic. But that's, 10,000 tons, that's about a tenth that's going to landfill in Australia, right? So we're a long way short from where we need to go, but we have got demand for our products. We're already working with over 200 feedstock suppliers. So there's plenty of people supporting us from that point of view, but we're not just taking it because they want to get rid of it. That 200 are all part of wanting to be part of this ecosystem that we're building. There's companies there who are waiting for us to be able to deliver them commercial scale volumes so they can bring that back into the supply chain. We're currently working across four industries, obviously textile and fashion, agricultural. So our cotton-based product called Celtex is being used as a fertilizer or as a hydro mulch, as a dust suppression. There's a whole bunch of opportunities we're working directly with farmers through universities and industry for that sort of product. It can also be brought into paints, mortars, and adhesives. So it can come back in that industrial space where we're replacing polymers. We're working in the building and construction industry, so we've got it going into concrete to provide strength, but also lowering the weight and making it more economical. We've got some other building products that are kind of looking from that point of view, from both the polymer and the cellulose point of view. Agriculture, fashion, textiles, building, and construction, and then the fourth part is a thing called injection molding, where you basically take our plastic pellets, melt them down, and pour them into a mold. So think of anything like a tabletop or some chairs, from a fashion point of view, coat hangers, like I mentioned, sunglasses, anything that can be injection molded, there's an opportunity to bring our products. And so we're looking at that from a point of view of both raw material supply, but also looking for some opportunities to have some BlockTech branded material out there in the marketplace to start to change the way we think about things, which is what you said at the start. You've got to be a manufacturer, but you've also got to be a person of thought leadership to change the way people think of things. So if you're putting a product in the marketplace, they go, "Oh, this is as good as this, and this is recycled, and what's the cost? They're the same. Well, I'll take the recycled, thanks." Right? So they're really exciting industries. We are looking at a second plant because obviously the problem's big here in Australia, but also New Zealand. The New Zealand government has approached us to come over to have a visit, to have a consideration of what it would look like to build a plant. Obviously, we know that you Kiwis, you're concerned about your environment. You know, rightly so. It's a beautiful part of the world. You're also wearing a lot of clothes, and you've got no option to, apart from landfill, or to export it to somebody else's landfill. So, but equally, there's a demand. There's a lot of industries who are looking for our recycled products to bring into their thing, to make them a better business, to make them be a more environmental product, and to meet the customer demand. And then the next goal for us is to, like I said, license our technology to a key partner around the world. I think Asia is a huge opportunity. We're already having conversations within the Asia region. Then we can start to deal with that source. So a lot of people don't know from a fashion industry, you can have somewhere between 8% and 25% leftovers from the cutting room. So as they cut around the patterns. So you think of that on the scale of the materials that we're making. So there's all this cut scrap that at times can be going to waste, or it's going to low value products, so such as being turned into rags where you wipe up the grease off your floor and then you throw it in the landfill. So there is certainly a demand across the industries that we're working here domestically, but obviously internationally. The fashion industry are making big claims about being more recyclable year upon year, and there just isn't the product. We're in a conference in Milan in June. There's a large textile conference, and all the textile recyclers got together, and the room was about 6 by 10, and there was 13 of us. That is the textile recycling industry in the world. Right. So it's so nascent, but it's so needed. And so we're just in that kind of early stage. There's policy being changed in Europe, policy being changed in the US. We're pushing very hard in Australia for policy change to get textile waste to be aligned with the ban in plastics, glass, and the other waste streams, because if we're banning sending your plastic bottle offshore, but we're not banning sending your polyester t-shirt offshore, and your beverage bottle, whether it's for Coke or Pepsi or whatever, is made of the same material as your polyester run shirt. It's made of from a PET, exactly the same. But we seem to care more about our recycling our plastic bottle that we've used once than the favorite t-shirt that we've used 100 times. So it's a misalignment both in government policy, but us as consumers. So we as consumers should be saying, we should be demanding that our governments are making sure we're recycling our clothing, because we're demanding to them to recycle our plastic bottle. These things have got to, they're not big picture stuff. It's like the laws are already there for the same plastic material. It's just in a different form. So it just doesn't make any sense.
add a sentence to the legislation almost to...
And Paul Lowe said, don't make things waste. It's not waste. If it can be recycled or resource recovered, it's not a waste, it's a value. Mm. And who decides to waste? Isn't somebody sitting there going, oh, you're a waste? Most of our material are coming out of laundromats. Like, it's washed. It's literally gone. This has been washed 80 times. We're taking it off the line. Right? We would normally send that off to landfill. They're going, no, it's coming to us now. So it hasn't gone anywhere near a waste management company.
Mate, lots of work to be done, but it sounds like you're doing it. So watch this space as block techs over the world.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Thanks for the support for that.
I think you're lined up for success. I mean, you've clearly been successful. The fact that you've invented a proprietary sort of mechanism, like, that's a success in itself. But you're getting, you know, you've got people paying you money, presumably to some degree, to actually get this done. So I just think you are a great example of the new type of business that the world needs, where you're solving, you know, more than one problem in a commercially successful manner. It can be done, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, sorry, not to labor on what I was thinking about this the other day, when we talk about the need to certify or validate your ESG reporting, right? I think of it from a different point of view. I kind of don't need to measure it because it's already baked into my business. So I don't need to go, oh, what did we do this month? What was our social impact? What was our environment impact? Because those things are already happening just by doing business. I've been thinking about this because we get asked a lot about, you know, how do you validate whatever. It's kind of, I can validate it, but it isn't the thing that means on Friday I've got to go, oh, I've got to do the numbers. Because if we hit our production process, I already know what my environmental impact is, and I already know what my social impact is. So I don't have to calculate that stuff because it's already just in the business. And yes, of course, we should report that, and I understand that. But I don't have to go chasing that numbers. I don't have to say, oh, God, our numbers are low on our ESG this month. We need to work a bit harder next month. And so mine can only go up.
Mm.
That's the exciting piece.
Yeah, 100%. You are a classic impact-driven business where revenue and impact are just, it's linked.
They're not decoupled.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that, again, which is why I think you're such a great example. And even the same with what you had at Kasaga. It's like you're both are great examples of, do you know Tim O'Brien?
Yes.
We had him on the podcast recently. He wrote a blog on LinkedIn a while back, sort of saying, oh, I think purposeful business is dead. It's about impactful business. And initially I sort of was sort of commented on it, and I was like, oh, I'm not sure I agree with this. But the more I understood his point of view, which we had a bit of a chat about during the podcast, no, I totally get it. What he was saying is businesses need to be like yours. Like the pure heart and intent of the business is creating positive impact. It's not so the purpose of the impact is strategy, not we are trying to sell as many packets of shit stuff that people don't really need But while we're doing that, we're going to give some money to charity, or we're going to offset the bad that we do by doing some good, which I think we're slowly moving from business as usual being, actually, we don't really give a shit about almost anything. Mm. And if we can get away with even worse behaviours, we would. But, you know, we've got to play by some rules. And, okay, yeah, we'll make some donations to charity, to possibly even some B Corps out there where they don't have an impact at the heart of what they do, that they are doing something else, but we're doing it in the best way that we can, and we're trying to do some social. But those are the ones who typically have to think about it, versus I am now 100% aligned with what Tim was saying, now that I fully understand it, is no, really, every business needs to have a clear impact at the heart of what it's doing. Otherwise, why are you here? So, yeah, kudos to you, man.
Thanks, mate. Appreciate that. But also, you know, companies like ours need cheerleaders like yourself, support. I mean, we've had plenty of conversations offline about, you know, working together, what you're doing with your business. It's those sort of conversations that all form my way of doing business or how I think about things. So it's always really valuable. Okay. Even if you don't have the opportunity to run a business like ours, it's about having a conversation with people like yourself, talking about this so you kind of understand exactly what I said. So you spoke to Tim, you kind of got a different viewpoint. This is really important because this still isn't the solution, you know. Mm. We have to keep evolving things. Society keeps evolving. We've got bigger problems to solve. And so the more we can all have conversations that are really open and honest and non-ego-driven or non-agenda-driven, then I think we can all learn a lot from different people's 100%. Perspective. And I think that's probably one of the other, from a B Corp point of view, it's not written about, but that's actually one of the great impacts of B Corp, is because you've got the opportunity to have a whole bunch of conversations with people that help to inform your opinion or the way you are doing your business, and that's really important.
Well, I think if I remember correctly, that's how we met. I just sent you an email. I was like, "Hey, I kind of like what you're doing. I'm a B Corp in New Zealand. Could we have a chat?" And you were like, "Sure." And we had a chat, and now we keep having chats intermittently. So, yeah.
So it started with you stalking me, and then eventually we end up here.
Basically, it was a long play.
I'm okay with that.
It was a long play in case I realized I was going to have a podcast and I might want to invite some people. Yeah, yeah.
But if we do come over there, you're the first person getting invited to get together for a drink and a strategy.
It sounds like a plan. Yeah. I would love to be a part of that. So
perfect.
Yeah, man. Hey, look, yeah, so thank you for everything you're doing. Keep up the great work. And yeah, let me know when you're over. Can't wait to see where this goes. I think it's going to go big.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. And good on you for doing this sort of podcast. It's very difficult for entrepreneurs at times to be able to have a chance to have a chat. And you know, you're making the effort. You're obviously a pretty busy guy. You don't need to take, you know, 2 hours out of your day to have a chat to a bunch of us so we can tell you about how good we are. But I appreciate that. And for me, it's a great honor. We've known each other for a short amount of time, but I'm a great admirer of what you do. It's a nice way to spend a Friday afternoon. So thank you.
Too easy. Craft beers next time.
Done.
Cool. All right, mate. We'll see you later.
Cheers.
Hey, it's Tim here, that B Corp bloke from Grow Good. If you want more content on purpose, B Corp, how to do more good in the world as an individual or a business, then you know the drill. Hit the like and subscribe. Check out some of my other videos. They're probably floating around here somewhere. You know how it works. Thank you so much. See you next time.